I said, well, let me ask you this. You like music, right? He said, oh, yeah, I love music. I said, we got great music at our church. Why don't you and your wife come to Easter services at our church? I think you'll love the music. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want to go to your stupid church.
That is Lee Strobel. You might know him as the author of the best-selling Case for Christ. He is here this week to talk about how to share Jesus in everyday situations. Hey, everyone, this is Lisa Anderson, and it is July 26th, the middle of summer. Kind of sad for me because, you know, I love summer. But this is also episode 547 of The Boundless Show, and we are grateful that you are here along with us. Later on, at the end of the show, we are answering a question from a listener who's wondering when to tell a date about her chronic illness. Well, here we are for our fun roundtable. I think we have a really interesting topic today. We are talking about cussing today on the roundtable. So let me go ahead and welcome our wonderful guests, Jake, Catherine, and Matt.
What'd it be?
Hello.
Hello. All right. Well, this is going to be fun. We actually had, when Catherine and I were in Dallas, we had this kind of conversation and this topic brought up as being a potential something to discuss, because I'm sure if you have lived more than 10 seconds in this world, you know that people use language. Some people think it's okay. Some people, it depends on what the words are. Some people, it depends who it's directed to. And some people are like, nope, never, you know, whatever. And so what is appropriate? What isn't? First thing I want to know is, what did you guys grow up with? What was okay? What wasn't okay? How did this play out in your homes? How were you raised?
No cussing and no pretend cuss words.
Euphemized like cussing.
No euphemisms. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember we could not say anything euphemized either. And I remember even after at college, my college graduation, I opened up a gift for my family, which was a brand new stereo. And I said, oh my gosh, thank you so much. And my dad pulled me aside and said, you know, Lisa, and gave me a big lecture. That is very inappropriate. We do not use, you know, it's God's name and whatever. So,
wow.
But my thing was, when I was growing up, my sister and I, we loved Christmas and we loved singing What Child Is This, because it was the only time of the year that we could say ass and not get in trouble. So we would sing it really loudly, and that was kind of our little, like, shake your fist at the man.
Oh,
but
man.
You know, can't say that I, you know, totally.
So you weren't raised on
me.
A good King James translation where you got to read about Balaam all the time.
Well, no, I mean, not so much. We just took advantage of. Yeah, maybe my parents deliberately kept us out of the Old Testament.
Right. That really, like, you don't need to be reading about Balaam's ass,
and
okay,
that,
Lisa?
That crazy Song of Solomon, too.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Intense.
Well, we don't get into that. But how about you,
yeah,
Matt?
We don't even talk about that on the
There's
podcast.
There's a whole segment
here,
of Christianity that I think thinks that's just, you know, in the Apocrypha somewhere.
Yeah. No, I think I had a similar upbringing. It wasn't as stringent. It just kind of wasn't a thing in our household. It wasn't really spoken about. It just wasn't there. But I do remember watching the movie Point Break with my mom at one point. Like, if you've ever seen, like, the old Point Break before, like, Keanu Reeves, right?
Right.
Was
yeah.
in it, and the other
Swayze,
guy,
right?
Patrick Swayze, yeah. It's a pretty explicit movie.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's other problems with Point Break than language.
I was a child. and I think she just turned to me at one point. She's like, you know, we don't talk like this, right, Matt? And I was just like, yeah. I don't feel like I should be here. I didn't say that part because I was thrilled to get to see a grown-up movie. But yeah, I think that was kind of the approach, which is like, it was understood, like, we don't talk like this yeah. in our home.
I actually think I was more legalistic about this than my parents were. They were pretty chill about it. I mean, there were rules, but I remember one time I was helping them with their business, and this lady was like talking to me, and I had to tell her the price of something, and she was like, oh, and then she cuts, and I was like, oh, Mom. That lady said, and my mom was like, yeah.
Like, run over and tell
People's,
her?
I did. I think I did. I, like, whispered in her ear. She was like, well, first off, you don't need to repeat her word. And second, yeah, people say that. And I don't know. It used to shock me.
Yeah. I still think it's shocking. And I think some of it is just from the way I was raised. But also, it's just kind of like, you just see that some people just use language. I mean, it just flows off their tongue, like, as part of their speech. I mean, it's one, I grew up like, oh, yeah, you know, like a car almost hit me on the freeway, or, you know, when something just like slips out. But now it's just like, I don't know, it just seems to be rolling off people's
casual.
Tongues a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of want to draw the delineation here about, I mean, it's one thing to be hanging out with like gangs or whatever in your language, like some extreme.
Are those the people that swear, Lisa? Is that where they all hang out?
As I do on weekends. Okay?
Great segue to legal.
But exactly. No, I'm just saying, like, it's what you would stereotypically associate rough language with,
right,
and whatever, and you
the
know,
mouth
oh,
of a sailor.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Or and that's exactly like, you know, my grandpa who was like, well, in the Navy, this is what we encounter. You know, whatever. It was always kind of a thing.
For the modern context, we would call, some people might call it locker room talk.
Right. Exactly. But now I'm kind of like, do you feel like there are a lot of Christians out there who have almost kind of started taking on more language in kind of the, I mean, I think it's a weird thing. I think it's something where people have become more assumptive about, in order to relate to the world, in order to be real, in, you know, and authentic, in order to, you've got to just start kind of putting this stuff out there.
Well, our listener Alex said that. She said she has a kind of quieter demeanor, mm-hmm, and so people don't take her seriously. And she literally said, it's unfortunate that cussing seems to force church people to listen to me. I was like, wow.
Yeah, that's weird to me. I just don't
get it. Yeah, I don't know about the emphasis part, but I do have friends, very good close friends, who I think listen to a Christian who swears because that, like, that shows them that, hey, this person's real. They have a past. Like, they've seen a part of the world that I have too. Like, we've sort of both got our scars, and this is one thing we carry with us, is that just, we just in general use foul language. So in some ways, I think it's kind of cool because it can bond people. Like, I have a couple friends who go to a prayer group in town, and like, it meets in somebody's house, and they have their children just running around like little kids, and you know, somebody's kind of sharing this rough part of their life, and they're getting frustrated, and they're just like, you know, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, and the dad of the kids who like hosts the thing, he like grabs his daughter, pulls him up on his lap, he's like, it's okay, nothing she hasn't heard before, we do swear in this house, and it was just like, whoa. Okay, it's a bunch of believers kind of just airing their frustrations with the world, and that's one way they're doing it. So I don't know if that's where we wanted the discussion to go, but that's one of my experiences with this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a middle ground between kind of what you're talking about and what Lisa's talking about, as far as, I don't know that there's a wide swath of Christianity. I think there might be a few pockets.
I don't think that's that the prevalent view.
Right. I don't think it's the prevalent
view. That's not even holy mind.
But even within those pockets that are becoming more comfortable with it, I think you even find some significant variations there. You have some that say, oh, to heck with it, none of it matters. Except they wouldn't say to heck.
Are we gonna bleep that?
Dave, get ready with that bleep button over there. But at the same time, there's been this, culturally, there's this kind of predominant stereotypical view of Christians as people who can't, like, who are snowflakes, mm-hmm, and can't, like, if they hear or see anything, it's like they immediately cover their eyes and stick their fingers in their ears. And so how could I go to that person if I'm not perfect? You know, how could I go to that person if I'm a little rough around the edges? And so I think some Christians, I think the heart of it started with, we want people to know we're not going to run away from them. We're not going to shy away from them if they're messy around us. We're not going to run that out. And then I think some Christians, you know, coming from that background, were then like, you know what? Sometimes this still comes out of me. Mm-hmm. But then some people have taken it to that extreme of, this is still who I am, and I'm how I'm going to live my life, like just letting it flow versus tempering it.
Yeah,
it does make, it alienates you sometimes. In college, I remember my friends cussed a lot. And one time I think I dropped something on my foot or something. And I was like, oh, gosh, dang it. And my friend looked at me and he was like, golly geez, Catherine, what'd you do? And then it kind of escalated into them like being like, why don't you ever like say stuff like this? Like they started asking me. And then it like kind of started bleeding out to like other things. And they were like, you probably never even kissed a boy. And like at that point I hadn't. And I was like, so I'm weird, I guess.
But at least it starts a conversation.
True.
I mean, what I think is fascinating is I have a good friend who became a Christian as an adult and who is really, like, she is in my Bible study now and has actually put, we did this thing where we wrote out prayer cards and exchanged them with one another, and on hers she put, I am really trying to overcome the outrageous amount of cussing that I do. And for her, it's a big thing. And for her, it's a very, she's very convicted of it. And she is really, she's like, I don't like the way I do it. I don't like the way I sound. But it is so second nature to her that she has honestly tried to put in, you know, it, she'll have these stops in her mind, you know, where she's like, wait, stop, think. I want to say that word. What can I say instead? And just processing it. And she's really trying to, you know, really kind of trying to put that before the Lord and saying, God, you know, I really want to almost in a way be delivered of that. And so that's when I think of her story, I just think that a lot of times we do treat it a little too cavalierly in the sense of like, oh, you know, it's no big deal. And not that you go after someone and are like, do not ever say anything in my house and like shunning people who struggle with it. Because she, I mean, I will say that, you know, sometimes she lets some stuff slip. And when you've heard something slip in reference to like a passage of the Bible that she's reacting to, it's kind of hilarious. But you're like, Jesus, I'm sure you understand. She didn't mean that about you. But anyway, but at the same time, she's really taking it seriously. Yeah. So I
because we're always pendulum people, right? Like we have this one side where we can't even be near this. It can't cross our ears or else we've sinned. But the like the other side, the flip side of that of saying, no, let's just let it flow freely from our lips. This is fine. We can just curse all we want and cuss all we want. That's not healthy either. Mm-hmm. The Bible, there is a biblical imperative to speak respectfully, to speak with wisdom, and you know, to speak with without being crass. And a lot of times, those words don't fit that mold. Most times,
yeah, that's really true.
And so there is there's that middle ground of we don't have to be scared. To your point of people. Where that happens, of people who do cuss, or if it does slip out, it's not your ticket, one way ticket to hell with no return. But
something Natasha said when we posted this on social media was she thinks the verse about don't let corrupting talk come out of your mouths isn't just about cussing, but about words that tear people down. And I've learned, honestly, in my life, some of the nicest people I know cuss. I used to work at a restaurant, and I remember one day I was 16, and this lady didn't cuss, but she said a lot of demeaning things about me. I went into the bathroom stall and cried and then kind of came out and walked to go get a drink, and the bartender was there. One of the sweetest ladies, and I'd heard her cuss several times that day, and she said the most comforting things to me in that moment. I just remember sitting there like, my ideals of like what makes a nice person are so wrong. And just because someone cusses does not mean that they're not nice or not a Christian.
Yeah. God is sanctifying us all.
Yeah. I've got a buddy who is probably 50 or 60 something. It's pinning down his age is actually really hard for this guy. But
50 or 60 something.
Yeah. Right. It's a wide window okay. with him, but he's one of the most impressive older guys I know. I mean, he's done crazy adventurous outdoors stuff. But he's also a minister and he has been for years, and he has like served the church most of his life. He's got a great family. He loves and is devoted to his wife and his faith. And he's got a theology that kind of blows me away every time we talk about it. But he'll swear like a sailor and he'll say the most culturally inappropriate things. He has a plaque on his wall that certifies he went through like anti-racism training at one point. To this day, I don't know whether
was
or not
he
it's
on
real.
The office?
And I don't know if his kids gave it to him as a joke or if it was real, but he's a swell guy. But he is very polarizing. I've been in environments with him with other people who are older and that I respect and will also swear, and they're just like, I don't want to be around this guy. Mm-hmm. But I have other friends who are like, wow, I really connect with him, and he's been able to speak into their lives in a very interesting way, a very powerful way, I think, that I'm not able to, in a sense, because I don't have that connection with them. Like, I don't have this kind of rough edge to me that they see in him.
But it's not that the language is the only thing that can give you a rough edge. I think that's sort of the half truth that can get us down the wrong path side of this path.
True.
Is that does not define a rough edge. Mm-hmm. Like, we have plenty of rough edges without that. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it's not that you have to condemn or, you know, that we throw out people when that is part of their rough edge. But again, I think we too often use that as an excuse to go to the other extreme with stuff and say, we do it with other things too. We do it with sex. We do it with, you know, say, well, at least I'm not going this far, you know, or this is my rough edge. Like, yeah, occasionally I watch a movie that has a sex scene in it, you know. It's because do we need that though? Mm-hmm. So, like, to that point,
wait,
it's not.
I understand you.
Well, I guess what I'm saying with him is it's not that.
Like, there are other ways to relate to people.
Is that
what
makes him relatable, or is it who he is as a person that makes him relatable? And could he in this other company not change who he is, but would there be a way where he could respect, you know, who they are as people? And again, it's not that he has to pretend to be perfect around them or pretend he doesn't have a past, but if he didn't, you know, tell X joke or say Y word, you know, would that make his presence bearable?
Yeah,
because
what good is
it if we're completely alienating other people? You know, is that much more effective of a witness?
Yeah. So the same guy,
if we're doing it needlessly, I guess I'm talking about needless offense. If they're offended because he happens to have a past, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But if it's like he could choose not to use this language around them and they'd be fine being around him. I don't know. Yeah. I guess that's a challenge, I think, and how we got to dig into this and get past the legalism side of it is to say, hey, what's your audience?
And almost find it attractive in a sense, because again, it's kind of like that. What is so different about that person, and why are they, whether they are angry or whatever, they're channeling it in a different way. And again, not to go the opposite extreme and be like, and so if you're a Christian, you better never say, you know, you're going to be defined by this, because you can have an ugly heart and have the best language in the world.
Right,
like
exactly.
Like Catherine was saying. So I'm just thinking, I just feel like for me, when I hear it, and I also want to make a distinction here that I'm going to make in a second, but I just think generally most language, it comes across very sloppy and very unprofessional, and makes me want to say to people, grab a thesaurus and figure out what you are actually trying to convey, because this is just the same old term for too many things that you're just using as a catch-all for stuff. I do want to draw the distinction that Lindsay did when she wrote into us, and that is this idea of almost like cursing versus cussing, and the idea of there's a difference between taking God's name in vain. And you, if I hear someone yell out like JC, I just like cringe. Like that, whether it's on TV, I don't care if it's fiction or whatever, but like that kind of like just flippancy or whatever around the name of God or Jesus Christ or whatever drives me like bonkers, much more so than just passive like other stuff.
And I think Lindsay also said directing it at someone like you are a blank is different than just saying the word.
That's definitely like technical cursing, right?
Right. Yeah. Like that's awful.
Right. Yeah. Again, with a heart intent and stuff that is bad. So that is just something that I think, and honestly, I would say that as believers, that is something that we truly do need to address with fellow believers. Like that is something that you call out with people of like, you know, I just, you know, and I mean, longer term, like I said, with my other friend who just said, overall, I want to improve my language. And so now she's asked me, you know, Lisa, when you hear me, just say something about that, you know, if you think I'm getting sloppy with that or whatever. But to directly address someone when they are actually offensively either using God's name or cursing someone else, you know, in a derogatory sense.
Words are so powerful. One of my friends from college actually killed herself a couple weekends ago. And I just, you know, you go over in your head and you can never blame anyone else for what happened. And there's all these things, but you never know what someone's thinking. You never know what they're going through. And I think, I mean, words can change people's lives. And so I think if you have a chance to say something to someone, using it to say things that are demeaning or, I mean, it's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not helpful at all and can be very, very hurtful. Yeah. And like you said, even with consequences.
But like you said, with the case of the bartender, you know, if she had sidled over and said, man, looks like you had a hell of a time with that gal, you know, she's using that as a way to put you at ease and say, you know, here, I'm here to be your friend. And, you know, I want to talk to you about what's going on. Like if you know somebody needs to hear that and you know, they kind of put you at arm's length and that might put them at comfort and you're not talking, you're not using that word at somebody, you know, that's again, maybe context.
I
matters.
Don't think it would be the best what? Use of Catherine's Christian witness.
I'm
to
not saying
say,
Catherine
excuse
needs,
me, yeah. can you yeah. please not say hell in my presence?
Right. Exactly.
That's yeah. gonna like get so, her not get her very far. Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're saying is when you're not directing it at somebody and you're trying to articulate a feeling or something like that, like profanity can almost be the best, like that's its best use. Is that what we're saying? I'm trying to. Okay, so
that is
sure.
not
here's
what I'm saying.
I get what you're getting at.
Yeah, here's what I'm relating to. There's There's a band called King's Kaleidoscope that's a Christian group, and they have a song in which the narrator voice in the song is describing like the pit that he's in, and the whole song is like, Jesus, where are you? Like, I'm not seeing you anywhere. Like, this is the darkest, worst things in my life are happening. And he uses the F word in the song at one point, just one time, I think. And it's the only explicit word on the whole album. Like, the whole album follows this kind of arc of like being like in God's presence and being feeling wonderful, and then reaching like that, what's the term? The valley of the shadow.
Yeah.
Right. Basically.
And the nadir.
The pit of despair.
The what?
It's just a word.
That's okay.
It's not a cuss word.
That's
despair.
What you should use instead of saying that word. Is you should say nadir.
This is why I'm saying grab a thesaurus, people. No.
Well, at one point he uses the term, this fear is tragic violence, I think. And then another time he replaces the word tragic with the F word. And it seems to me like a very good articulation of where a lot of people reach that point in life where they're like, there's no hope. There's nothing. Like, this is all I have right now.
Yeah.
And that's not directed at anybody. It's just an articulation of a human feeling.
Sometimes they can, as many other words as there are more appropriate for 99% of contexts, certain really emotional moments, like I get, you know, what would be the case if you're in the midst of intense spiritual warfare with somebody and they're battling with the demons of their past and they evoke the words of Jesus to say, get behind me, Satan, but in their anger, in their rage, as they're being tempted by the specter of their past, they say, get the F behind me, Satan. Because they are just built up and they are tired of losing this battle to Satan. You know, that's a strong emotion. It might be contextually appropriate. I'm not saying I should do
something
that.
Here.
We'll create a boundless meme with that. With that and put it out there and just sign it with Jake's name.
Can we?
So, all right.
But sometimes they are like to your point, Matt, they express these deep emotions that we don't have words for.
Yeah.
And or some it's people not don't,
not everybody
in that moment.
Right. Like it's not meant to be
a
guttural.
Thesaurus moment there for sure. I think there's a lot of warrant to that.
Yeah. I just think it's a reminder to all of us to be more thoughtful in our speech and in our heart. And quite frankly, if we do feel convicted, we need to take that seriously. And if, you know, and yet again, not to be parsing out words like they are the be all end all, you know, means of our salvation.
Right.
And so, yeah. Well, all right. Thanks, guys. We're gonna wash Matt's mouth out with some soap, and then we will move on.
Be a good burrito.
You should wash out the mouth of a highly acclaimed Christian group, then too. Get a hold of him.
We will.
What's his name? Chad? Something like that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. A single precious. Well, hey, everyone. We are here for this week's culture segment, and I'm going to introduce you to Lee Strobel. You may know him because you have read the book The Case for Christ, and now that he's a film superstar as well, having been involved in a film project related to that, you know, we just know that he's super cool, but he is here to talk with us today, and we're going to have fun doing that. So, Lee, welcome to the Boundless
Thank
Show.
Thank you. I've never been accused of being super cool. That was the first time. I'm going to put that on my resume.
We believe that people should just we name it, and then they can aspire
there
to
you
it.
Go.
So,
That's
you know,
great.
Having been on the Boundless Show, that's just going to label you right there.
Well, I will say the Forbes magazine called me the cooler Han Solo.
Oh, wow. Well, what in the world? That's pretty awesome.
I know.
That's good.
I thought
that
was really cool.
That's great. Well, we know, I mean, those who have followed you for a long time, not that you're old, but we're just going to put it out there. You know, I mean, many folks know you as having worked for the Chicago Trib back in the day, being an atheist who set out to disprove the claims of Jesus Christ and became a Christian in the process. After your wife had already become a Christian, you were freaked out by that.
Yeah.
So wondering, was your marriage even going to hold together with this this Jesus freak now that was in your home? Well, you are obviously the person then to talk about the topic we're going to talk about today, which is really extending yourself and being a normal Christian living in the real world, but being compelled to share Christ with the people who are in our sphere. And you've actually written the book with Mark Middleberg, The Unexpected Adventure, Taking Everyday Risks to Talk with People About Jesus. And so we're gonna do that.
Cool.
This will be fun. So, okay. I think this is just one of those weird, like, awkward things that we find ourselves in. Because you think to yourself, you know, and you've heard it from the pulpit, okay, you need to go out and evangelize. You need to share Christ. You need to, and we know any of us that have been around in the last 15, 20 years, been alive, there are lots of tools to make that happen. A lot of folks have been like, okay, memorize this or use this, you know, pattern of whatever, or do this or that. And then we just kind of freeze up and we don't do anything.
Right.
First of all, how do we even, you know, we feel like if we don't just see the non-Christians in our life and immediately want to spurt out, you know, the gospel to them, that we must not be Christian enough or spiritual enough.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about the heart connection with how we get the want to do this.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. We titled the book The Unexpected Adventure because we really want to posture it that way, as being an adventure where you don't know what's going to happen. That's a little scary, but we fortunately got on our side, so we don't have to be too scared.
Yeah.
And what's the worst thing that someone can say to us? Well, I'm not interested in talking about that. Well, that's not going to crush us.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think when Jesus said to be salt and light, what he meant was to be salt, in other words, to make people thirst for God, to be light, to shine his message of hope and grace where we go. And that doesn't mean grabbing people by the collar and spouting four spiritual laws at them necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about the fact that in America, the average person who comes to faith hears the gospel six times before they come to faith.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you may be number three.
Yeah.
You may be number six. I think one thing that's been encouraging to me and to a lot of people is what my friend Cliff Konecki said. Cliff is a sidewalk evangelist for universities. He used to be. And he was very good at it. He was not obnoxious. He was just very good at it. But here's what he says. He says, you know, a person coming to faith is like a chain with many links. He said there's a first link, a middle link, and a last link. He said, sometimes I'm a first link. Sometimes I'm a last link. But most of the time, I'm a middle link.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I have not been called by God just to be a last link.
Mm-hmm.
I have been called to love God and to love people. And I think that's the key. If we love God and we love people and we seize those opportunities that God opens up to have a conversation about matters of faith, where we ask more questions than give answers, where we validate the person as being valuable in the eyes of God, where we respect them as being on a journey. They may not be as far as we are yet. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where we have a no strings attached attitude, where we say, you know, I'm going to be your friend regardless of whether you ever come to faith.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have. So I think that idea of being links in a chain is liberating.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in baseball. You know, if you don't necessarily have to hit a grand slam every time you're at the plate. Sometimes the person's on third base and you just got to bunt.
Yeah.
And, you know, so sometimes we're interacting with someone. They're very close to coming to faith. We just need a little bunt to get them across the home plate. So I find that to be an encouragement.
Yeah, that's great. You actually have a story related to that that I'd love for you to tell about inviting a coworker to an Easter service, showing up at the office and making that happen, and then actually hearing from someone down the road related to that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was. I was a pretty new Christian, still an editor at a newspaper in Chicago, and I was getting ready to go home that day. And I felt very specifically compelled by God to go into the business office and to share share my faith and invite my atheist friend to Easter services at our church. And because I felt so convicted I needed to do this, I thought something great's going to happen, mm-hmm. right? So I walked in with great confidence and looked around, and all I saw was my friend behind his desk. So I said, hey, how you doing? He said, I'm doing great. I said, hey, you know, Easter's coming up. He said, well, Strobel, you know I'm an atheist. I don't observe Easter. I said, I know, but Easter's when we remember the resurrection of Jesus. He said, oh, he wasn't resurrected. I saw actually as good historical evidence he was, and began to give him some of the evidence historically that convinced me that Jesus did rise from the dead. And I went on for a few minutes, but I could tell with him it wasn't working. So now I'm scrambling. What do I say? So I said, well, let me ask you this. Do you ever have any questions about God? He said, no. Okay. I said, do you ever think about God? He said, no. I said, well, let me ask you this. You like music, right? He said, oh, yeah, I love music. I said, we got great music at our church. Why don't you and your wife come to Easter services at our church? I think you'll love the music. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want to go to your stupid church. So I said, okay, hey, listen, you know where my office is if you ever got a question. And I walked out and I thought, what was that about? Why would my wires get crossed here? Because to this day, he's still an atheist. Mm-hmm. But then several years later, I was a pastor at a church outside Chicago, and a man came up to me after a service and said, can I shake your hands and thank you for the spiritual influence you've had in my life? I said, well, it's real nice, but who are you? He said, let me tell you my story. He said, a few years ago, I lost my job. And I didn't have any money. I was afraid I was going to lose my car. I was going to lose my house. I needed a job for a while, a paycheck. So I called a friend of mine that ran a newspaper. I said, do you have any odd jobs I can do to earn a check for a while? The guy said, well, can you tile floors? And I said, yeah, I've tiled our bathroom. He said, well, we need some tiling installed and repaired at the newspaper, so if you can do that, we can pay you for a while. So he said, great. So he said, I went to work at the newspaper. So he said, one day, not long before Easter, I was in the business office in the newspaper. Now I was on my hands and knees working on the floor on some tile behind a big desk, and you walked in. I don't even think you saw me there. And you start talking to this guy about God. And you start talking about the resurrection. You start giving the evidence Jesus rose from the dead. You start inviting him to church. And this guy was shutting you down. But I'm sitting here on my hands and knees working on this tile, and I'm hearing all this stuff, and I'm thinking, I need God. I need to go to church. So he said, as soon as you left, I called my wife. I said, we're going to church that weekend, Easter. She said, what? I said, yeah. So he said, we came to your church that Easter. I came to faith. My wife came to faith, and our teenage son came to faith. And I just wanted to thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
So I thought this is a new form of evangelism, ricochet evangelism. You know, you share your faith, it bounces off a hard heart. You don't know where it's going to go.
You were both link one and link three in the same conversation.
That's right. See? And you know, the funny thing is, I think in heaven, we're going to find out about a lot of times when we felt bad because we felt like we blew it, where we tried to explain the gospel, we kind of faltered or fumbled, and the guy walked away, or the gal was not interested, and we felt bad. And we're going to find out in heaven, a lot of those people are going to be there, mm-hmm. and we're going to be link one through five, and we never knew that they came to faith. God will do as God will do, and I think it's never wasted when we share Jesus with someone.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. I mean, I know in my own situation, I have a good friend who had described herself as a Methodist Buddhist, I think, like it was some kind of ethnicity or whatever.
Right.
And I remember I'd shared the gospel with her, like, you know, front to back and all the, you know, did the big sell and everything. And she was just like, yeah, you know, thanks, whatever. And then when my dad died, it was like 4 months later. And she was like, hey, you know, I'd love to take you out to lunch and just talk about how you walked through that season, because I just saw a piece about you. And I remember being all offended, you know, like, oh, seriously? Like, I've shared the gospel with you several times and now you just want to talk about this.
Yeah.
But like, I was so concerned with, like, you know, what my words were, what I was saying. And it was like, God chose to use actually a hard time in my own life to speak louder than me making some presentation to her. And we ended up having a great, great conversation about that.
That's a great example.
It's really fun. I mean, speaking of, Lee, I want you to talk to, you know, I think a lot of times we feel like if we're going to share the gospel, we have to be ready to answer every question that may come up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been in a situation where it's like, okay, well, you know, tell me about, I'm just trying to share my faith very simply. And someone's like, yeah, but what about the Crusades? Or what about abortion? Or they start bringing in all these other topics. And then I'm like, blah, you know, what do I say? How can we even have the courage to step forward and share in a winsome way when we may have a fear about, like, what if I can't answer all the follow-ups?
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are questions for all of us that we can't answer. Mm-hmm. And I think the key thing is we have to be emotionally and intellectually prepared. When someone asks us a question, sometimes we need to say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay to say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because the next thing you can say is, but let's find out together. So if they ask me a tough question, I say, you know, golly, I don't know the answer, but why don't we check it out? And then there's all kinds of Christian resources out there now that can help you do that. It gives you another chance to have a God conversation, another chance to engage spiritually, and can lengthen the opportunities and the relationship and so forth and deepen the relationship. So I think we got to be honest. You know, I mean, I've been stumped many times with a question, and but God's opened up the door to go further with the person.
Yeah, that's good. To that point, we receive a lot of questions from our listeners who want to know about sharing their faith in the context of work.
Yeah.
So they're at Bible study, they're in church, they're around their Jesus people and right. feel really confident, really secure. But then they're like, oh, great. Well, I don't want someone to hate me. I don't want someone to sue me. I don't want someone
yeah,
to...
Yeah, exactly.
What are great natural segues in the workplace to talk about faith?
It's a touchy issue because especially if you're in a supervisory role, because you don't want to communicate to your coworkers or to your colleagues or to people who report to you that I'm going to judge you differently because you're not a Christian. So, you know, it's snarky. Mm-hmm. I think we have to be careful that we don't communicate those kind of impulses. But I think often at work, at least in my experience, we develop some of the best relationships, you know, friendships and people you really like, and you like hanging around with them. And so what
just
often happens—
just the sheer value of time you spend with someone at work is a huge chunk of your life.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there are people you like to go to lunch with and people you like to, you know, have a go out after lunch and after dinner or whatever and get together. And so I try to, at least when I was in the newspaper business, to rely on those off-hour opportunities. So— to spend my time at work trying to live out my faith in an authentic way, certainly respond to questions as they come up or whatever. But when I wanted to get into a serious spiritual conversation, that's usually when I invited someone out to lunch. Mm-hmm. And it's very important that you do it one-on-one. Mm-hmm. I've never been mocked or challenged for my faith on a one-on-one relationship or conversation, whereas in a group, people get very snarky. So you try to have a one-on-one conversation. But I'll give you a quick example. My boss, when I was a brand new Christian working at the newspaper, it was going to be a very busy day at the paper. And I prayed and said, God, help me get through this day. I know it's going to be hard. And he did. I really got through it well. And so my boss came up to me afterward and he said, hey, Strobel, man, I saw you really handled yourself great today. That was terrific. And then he had invited me out earlier to go golfing on Sunday, and I turned him down as I was going to church. So he knew I was a Christian. And it's good to plant those kind of seeds just so people know you're a believer. So he said to me, so what's this Christianity thing to you? Because he saw in me something in that day that brought a calmness and a peace in the midst of the turmoil of the newsroom that intrigued him. So I'd never shared my faith before. I thought, you really want to know? And he said, sure. So I said, well, let's go in your office. So we went into his office and closed the door. And for the next 45 minutes, I just gushed out. I made every mistake probably in every evangelism course in the world. Just told him my story of coming to faith, why I believe, and so forth. And when I walked out of that encounter, it was like my entire life up until that moment had been a black and white movie made on 16-millimeter film with scratchy sound. But that 45 minutes was like Dolby stereo with Technicolor. And that's what really told me, I need more of this in my life. That's the unexpected adventure mm-hmm. of the Christian life.
Yeah, that's cool. I have a friend who also became, you know, another unique way I think a lot of folks can step into this space is to kind of be that listening ear
yes.
for folks. There are so many people, I remember just coworkers telling her, even talking about wanting to date and mm-hmm. saying, if I want to find someone quality to date, I just don't know what to do other than hang out at bars. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just what we do. And just being a listening ear to those folks about,
right. right.
with their problems and about the challenges, because we're so self-focused that I think Christians have the opportunity to step outside of ourselves and be in that space for folks.
I think that's especially true when someone, a colleague or someone at work, is going through a tough time that you know about. In other words, a mom dies. Or and, you know, it's funny how, and I think back to the death of my parents, how few comments I got or anything from my non-believing friends at the newspaper. I remember very vividly those that did reach out to me in those moments of crisis. And we can do that. We can be a listening shoulder. We can be a, someone to empathize. And you know, they're going to see something in us through that that I think is going to spark spiritual curiosity.
Yeah, it's funny because my mom actually died a few months ago, and I was pulling into my neighborhood and up to the mailboxes. And I actually had one of my neighbors follow me out to the mailbox because he'd heard that mom had died. And he just started a conversation, just plowed in, and he's like, "Lisa," he said, "so sorry about your mom." He said, "You know, I just really, you know, I feel so bad and stuff." And I said, "Oh, thank you so much." And he just starts in. He's like, "Do you like think about heaven a lot?" It was just, he had lost his mom not too long ago, and it just brought that up. And it was just a great entree for me to talk, whereas probably I wouldn't have had that opportunity moving in with any other subject or any other moment, you know, where I would have tried to force it. But just to have that opportunity was so cool.
Just to have our antenna up. And to be aware of those key moments in people's lives that are happening. Where they're really, they won't say it, but they're looking for someone to connect with.
Okay, so opposite end of the spectrum now, because now you've been a teaching pastor in churches, you teach in a Christian institution. And you're just Mr. Christian now, Lee. You know, you're not in the newspaper biz as much. And what about those folks who maybe feel like they can't get out of the Christian bubble or that Christian, you know, I go, you know, maybe I work wherever I work, or I work for a Christian organization. Then I'm in Bible study. Then I'm in church. How can they create relationships with folks in the sphere that they run in where they feel like they're having to craft something or force it?
Right. And I think the word, the key word there is intentionality. We have to be intentional, because we got to break out of this Christian cocoon that we're in sometimes to relate to those people who desperately need Christ outside the church. And a couple things we can do. Number one is invite non-believers into activities that you're doing anyway. In other words, none of us has extra time in our lives. If you say to someone, "Hey, you got an extra 10 hours a week to go out and build relationship with unchurched people?" No, nobody does. But you can invite them into something you're going to do anyway. You know, if I'm going to wash my car, I could say to my non-believing neighbor, "Hey, why don't you bring your car over? We'll wash them together." I'm not going to add 1 minute to my time, but we build a relationship, and who knows what God might open up in terms of an opportunity. We're going to watch a sporting event on TV. Invite your non-believing neighbor to come watch it with you. During the commercials, who knows what conversations might flow. I have, if you look on my calendar, I have a paper calendar with a box for every month because I don't know how to work computers. And so and at the beginning of every month, on the first day, you'll see two things. First thing is a marriage thing that I ask myself every 30 days. And the question I ask myself is, how would I like to be married to me? So I have that on the first day of the month. So I ask myself that question. It helps kind of me to, you know, figure out what I need, how I need to improve as a husband. The second thing on my calendar is, who are you reaching out to this month? And so I'll look at my month and I'll say, nobody. I don't have anything. There's no lunch schedule with a non-believer. There's no activity schedule, no golf game, nothing. So then I'll get on the phone and connect with a non-believing friend or someone in the neighborhood and say, "Hey, let's get coffee next Tuesday," or whatever. I want to get something on the calendar. And it helps to have accountability. My friend Mark Middleberg, who co-wrote the Unexpected Adventure book with me, we hold each other accountable. Who are you building a relationship with? Who are you praying for? Who are you reaching out to? And so it's not a guilt trip thing. It's just a gentle encouragement to say, let's be heads up and be intentional. The other thing is, and I do this a lot, this is one of my main forms of what I call the unexpected adventure. I call it strategic consumerism. And by that I mean, I go out and Leslie and I eat out a lot at restaurants, not fancy restaurants, just hole-in-the-wall places. We like to do it. We're kind of foodies. So what do? We try to go back to the same restaurant over and over and over again. Why? So we can get to know the owner and the wait staff and the cooks and so forth. And we become like their pastor. I mean, we get to know them. We tip them well. Every Christmas, we give them a little financial bonus, but we also give them a copy of one of my books or a tape or Christian material. We look for opportunities to get into spiritual conversations. So sometimes they'll come and they'll sit down with us, you know, and when things are going slow, and we'll have a conversation, and they'll tell us about their lives. And we kind of see them like our kids, because there are a lot of them are younger than our kids, and we kind of feel parental toward them. And we've gotten to build so many great relationships with so many people. And I'm thinking recently, one of them was a guy who came to the United States from Colombia, South America. He's a drummer in a rock band at night, and he's worked as a waiter at this one restaurant we would go back to. I don't like Mexican food. It's not, I just don't like it. I eat at a Mexican restaurant at least 3 days a week because I like the people. Because the people, I love the people.
Yeah.
And so he was one of them. And so Leslie and I were just a few weeks ago having lunch there, and he was serving some other tables, and he came up to us. And I'm telling you, just the look on his face, I knew something had happened. Mm-hmm. It was his face was just bright. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, "I did it. I received Christ. Aww. I prayed to receive Christ." And he said, "And I met a guy, and he's a Hispanic pastor, and he's a wonderful guy, and I love going to his church. I love reading the Bible." And he was so excited. And I said, that's why, even though I don't like Mexican food, it's why we keep coming back to this place, because I love these people. And that's been a joy. We're going to go out and eat anyway, because my wife doesn't particularly like to cook. And so if we can combine it with opportunities to share Christ, that's the best of both worlds.
That's super cool. Just as we finish here, Lee, just give us a quick idea, because we've talked a lot about strategies for meeting people and sharing and inviting. Talk to us a little bit about the supernatural. How do we partner with God in this process, trust him in prayer, trust the work of the Holy Spirit to go before us, and really be mindful of that as we're seeking to be in relationship?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I just wrote a book called The Case for Miracles, because I tend to be a very rational person. I did come to faith through the miracle of the resurrection, for the evidence for it. But I want to know, is God still doing miracles? Is he still involved in the world? And I spent 2 years investigating the supernatural for that book, and it's really made me much more attuned to the supernatural. And so, you know, we're not alone in this process. That's the encouragement I get, is to know that the Holy Spirit is always with me, and that he is in me, and that he's going to use me, and that he's going to give me the words to say, and that he's going to be working simultaneously in the heart of this person I'm talking to, and that and just to be not alone in this scary, because it is a scary process. Everybody, Luis Palau, the famous evangelist who's shared the gospel through his public rallies with millions of people. My buddy Mark and I asked him once, "Do you ever get nervous when you talk one-on-one to someone?" He said, "Every single time." We all get nervous, but to know that we're not alone, that God is sovereign, that, you know, it doesn't depend on how well we explain the gospel. What matters is we love God, we love people, he'll work through us. We just need to relax in that. And I think through that, we'll be stronger salt and brighter light.
So true. All right, folks, the book is The Unexpected Adventure, Taking Everyday Risks to Talk with People About Jesus. And what's so cool about this book is it's a collection of stories. So actual boots on the ground, real life stories of how this has been put into practice, and to encourage you and to realize that you do have a part in this, and it can be really exciting. So, Lee, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, folks, we are finishing out the show with our inbox, and we have got actually one of our culture guests. She was on the show a little while back, Chelsea Patterson Sobolik. She's the author of Longing for Motherhood, and we had a listener question that we thought would be perfect for her. So, Chelsea, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
All right. Our listener says, I have a chronic illness that's going to affect me for the rest of my life. When I date, I'm not sure when it's the best time to tell guys about it. Should I tell them within the first few weeks so they know what they're getting into, or should I tell them later when they've gotten to know me better?
Well, such a good question. And first of all, my heart goes out to this listener. Mine's a little different. I can't have children, but I knew before I got married that I couldn't have children, so I had to tell someone when I was dating them. So a couple of thoughts. Number one, I would say it depends on how well you know the person you're dating. So if you know this guy for 5 or 6 years and you start dating, that's going to look a little bit different because you have an existing friendship, you know each other, so you're going to be moving probably a little quicker than if you went on a blind date or just started dating someone. So I would say, number one, your existing relationship to this person is going to play a factor. Number two, do not feel pressured to share too quickly. This is, I think a lot of times friends and family can have their own suggestions, but it's your relationship. So don't feel pressured to do it like, oh, it's been 2 weeks. I need to tell him or whatnot. Go at your own speed and give yourself grace to share when you feel ready. And that could be within 2 weeks of starting to date someone, or it could take 2 months. Number three, I would say to pray and ask God for wisdom in this, because it will affect your marriage and how you, if you do get married, it will touch that, because, you know, everyone brings something into a marriage. And so I would also say don't look at yourself as bringing this huge thing into a marriage and they're not bringing anything, because each person brings something, and this is just what God has given you to walk into a marriage. Number five, I would say to have friends and family praying for you as you're seeking when to tell this person about your chronic illness. But it honestly boils down to your comfort level and when you feel comfortable sharing. So if you are head over heels for this guy, maybe it is in the first month or so. But again, it's your timetable. Those are just a few thoughts on when I think it would be appropriate to tell someone you're dating.
Yeah. So when, I know that you had to actually do this with your husband, what did that look like for you? How did you decide the timing on that?
Yeah, so we were actually friends for 3 years before we started dating, so I knew him pretty well. I told him a month and a half into dating, so not super quick, but I didn't delay either. But again, I had an existing relationship, but I was smitten with him, and I thought, you know, if any more time goes on and I don't tell him, I feel like I was doing him a disservice. So that's why I told him when I did. I was smitten. I wanted to keep moving forward with him. And I personally felt like the more time that passed, I was doing him a disservice by not sharing with him.
Yeah, so. And that's a good point, because obviously dating him and being interested in him is a game changer. And so yep. Putting your cards on the table was probably a scary, but a good thing to have done that.
Yes.
And awesome. Yep. Well, thanks so much. Yep. Awesome.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that is it for this week's show. As always, we do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org, and hopefully we can answer your question in the future. Meanwhile, you can find out other questions that we've answered, as well as some of the other content we have on the site, by going to boundless.org. And you can certainly search there under a number of various topics that we have. So super cool. You can find out more about this show by going to boundless.org and searching 547. That's the number of this show. We will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.